Good morning. Thanks a lot for inviting me to this conference. When Carlo called me and he said, well, will you give a talk at this conference? I was very happy because it was a nice opportunity to meet all my friends from my graduate period. But I warned him. I said, Carlo, I'm doing something completely different, really something completely different. It's still physics, but it's not macroscopic physics. It's perhaps nano system physics because we use very small cells and DNA and RNA polymerase is very small. But it's really, really different from conductance fluctuations, nanotubes, and things like that. So we'll see if you like this. I hope so. One of my goals is to arouse you and to show you that this kind of physics and biophysics is really interesting, and we really need some theoretical physicists to come to this area. So I'm experimentalist. I will show you some theories we developed ourselves. That's just because they're not theorists. We have to do the theory ourselves. But it would be really nice to attract more quantitative people to. Is it not loud enough?
You should speak a little more loudly.
Okay, push this. So, the title of the talk is better. I think it's even worse now. The title of the talk is Noise Regulation in Gene Expression. And most of the experiments we do nowadays are focusing on one single gene. So this is my physics background. You say, okay, I don't want to study this huge complex system. I take a single element, a single molecule. No, you take a single gene, which is in a sense a molecule, but to be able to really express it, to be functional, you need a lot of molecules. So it's in a sense a very messy system compared to a single nanotube or something like that. But this is something that is very strongly related to biology, is that biology is complex. So this is a paradox in biophysics, is that physics is something that studies well-defined systems, single molecules, single atoms. Biology is very complex inherently, because to be able to survive, you have to be complex. There are all kind of different reactions that are going on. So how do you combine these two fields? That's one thing I will try to show you, that it's possible actually to use physics in a very useful way to learn something about biology. So this is the outline of the talk. Please interrupt me if I'm using language that's not clearly defined. So I've been in this area now for a couple of years, and sometimes I'm defining terms anymore, because I'm assuming you know what translation, transcription is, RNA polymerase. I will define it, but please interrupt if I have to define it again. So first I will give an introduction about how can you view cells as an interesting nanosystem, because this is a conference on nanoscience. Can a cell be an interesting system to look at? Then I will zoom in on noise and fluctuations in these systems, because that's our goal for my group, is to learn more about noise in gene expression. And I will try to explain that it's relevant for biology. I think it's really important when you do this work in biophysics, your first thing you have to ask yourself, is this relevant for biology? You don't want to just play games with biology. You just want to learn some important things about biology using physics. So I think this noise is very important in biology and also in applications. So engineers, bioengineers are very interested in using these cells as sensors, send out cells in the environment to sense, for example, chemicals. Or if you're really brave, you can use this as bits, really classical bits. There's not quantum computation going on. It's all room temperature, very noisy. But if you want, you can use this as computational devices. They're very cheap. You can make a lot of them in a very small volume. This is not my expertise, but people are thinking about that. Then I will show you some models. How can you quantitatively think about noise and expression of a gene? I will show you the experimental data we obtained in the lab, and I will show you that actually noise in a gene is something that's not random or it's just changing all the time, but it's actually programmed in the cell. So a cell has a certain noise strength that's programmed in the genetics. So when you have a cell and you know all the chemical parameters, you can actually calculate the noise. And evolution, by putting mutations into the DNA, can change the noise, because the noise is defined by the chemical parameters in the cells, by the sequence, the local sequence. That's my claim. And in discussion, I will talk about how this is relevant, for example, on the scale of evolution or can you use these experiments to predict more, can you use it for more complex systems? And what our future plans are and what the theoretical challenges are in this field. So this is a cartoon of E. coli cell, which is a bacterial cell, which is about, it's the most common bacteria which is in your body, it's in your intestines. It's very important for digestion of the food, to keep you alive, and it's everywhere. Biologists like this bacteria a lot because it's sequenced completely. They know the base pair, all the base pairs of the genome. It has been studied for 50 years by a lot of biologists, so they know really a lot about this little creature. So it's about 1 micron in size. If you want to talk about memory, there's about a million base pairs, so megabyte of information. It lives about 30 minutes, then it divides, makes 2 daughter cells that go on with their life. The DNA is duplicated, replicated, identically, if there's no mutation. These systems are organizing themselves. You don't have to do anything, it's just a self-organizing system. They're very adaptive, they adapt to the environment very fast. They're very cheap. Now, if you think about, if you're an engineer and you want to make these things, they're very, very cheap. You just need some, sugar to feed them, and that's it. And they're very well characterized. Now, a lot of people think this is a very messy system, but that's not true. The genome of this bacteria is completely known. And you can completely change it if you want. If you say, okay, I want to change number 35 into a different base, you can do that. Very well controlled. It's really, all the techniques are very, very straightforward in a sense. And you can control everything. You can test it. You can read out the DNA. It's easy to manipulate. And that's because the molecular biology is nowadays very, very strong. They can sequence anything. They can put in any base pair they want. And they can mutate proteins. So in a sense, the sample fabrication is thought out. Everything is known. You can fabricate these systems. Just to try to impress you a little bit by showing you a couple of examples of what these bacteria can do. So Howard Berg at Harvard quoted in Physics Today that this E. coli is a self-replicating object about a micron in size. It swims 30 times its own size in a second, which is very fast. It's, compared to a cheetah, if you scale it down. And it can taste chemicals in the environment. It has a taste for different chemicals. And it can actually decide if life is getting better or worse. So it can try, for example, to make a spore or to replicate itself faster. And it's all done by a little engine, which is at the back of the bacteria, which is called the flagella. So it's kind of a rotary motor. And the rotary motor is connected to a pathway, a signal transduction pathway. So this is a complex cascade of all kinds of proteins that react with each other when some food molecule binds to the surface of the bacteria. So in this way, the bacteria can find the source of the food by switching this engine to the right or the left. It has 2 modes. It can go clockwise or counterclockwise. And in this way, it makes a biased random walk that ends up at the maximum concentration of food. Another example is the metabolism. Bacteria can not only find food, they also can make a decision, a rational decision about what they want to eat. So these experiments were done by Jacques Monod, which is a molecular biologist, got the Nobel Prize for this work a long time ago, where he measures how many cells do you have in your tube as a function of time. So its cell density is a function of time. And normally what you see is that it exponentially grows because these bacteria divide every 30 minutes, so you have some exponential growth, and that's what you see most of the time, and then it stops growing. But for example, when you give the bacteria a sugar source that consists of a mixture of glucose and xylose, which is in this picture, you see that there's a step in the middle. So what people think is that first the bacteria eat up all the glucose, and then they wait a while because they have to switch their machinery from the glucose eating state to the xylose eating state, and then they start to chew on the xylose. So they actually decide first to eat this one because it's much richer in energy, and then they eat the other component. So they can sense where it is, but they can also decide which to eat first. So, and this is like a very, very small, simple creature. Time. piece will be ours. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so this is kind of the introduction to a bacteria as a nanosystem. It's a very complex system, but it's very efficient and very powerful. This is one of the major dogmas in biology, which is called the central dogma, which illustrates the information flow in a cell. So we have DNA, which is kind of the library. It consists of nucleic acids, millions to billions of base pairs. Then the library is read by a molecule which is called RNA polymerase and makes RNA molecule out of that. RNA molecule is a single-stranded molecule, then it's then read by another molecule which is called the ribosome, and it's translated into a protein. So proteins are the real molecules you need in your body to do all these fancy tasks like finding food sources and finding what kind of sugar you want to eat. The DNA is passive, it's not doing anything, it's just storing information. So gene expression is this scheme. So you need a certain protein at a certain time, so you go to the library and you say, I want to read this part, I want to make that protein. That's the process of gene expression. And what we are studying is that this cascade is a noisy cascade. There's a lot of noise sources in here, and actually these noise sources are deterministic in a sense that they are defined by the parameters, the efficiencies of these two steps. So let me put this one there, because this is a really important one. So if you can't see it, too bad. It's just a lot of terminology is defined in there.
What triggers the process?
For example, when you have a molecule that binds the membrane, there is another protein that switches on that process so that the bacteria can now find that molecule. So there are molecules at the surface of the bacteria that are receptors that kind of can function as a receptor, as a function, as a trigger for this process. So if you need a certain protein because you sense that there is a certain chemical in the environment, then there's a cascade that will trigger that. So the important thing to realize is that there's thousands of proteins in your body or in a cell. So there are like 1,000 parallel pictures of this in a cell. And each of the proteins can switch on another protein, so it's a very complex system. So what we do now, if you just look at one single gene, which we can trigger ourselves externally. Okay, so again, here's the central dogma. So you go from DNA, RNA, to protein. The first step is called transcription. The second step is called translation. And the two protein machines that do the job are RNA polymerase and ribosomes. So when you look in a typical bacterial cell and you count the number of molecules that are available for this process, they're very small numbers. There's only one DNA molecule. It's only one library. You replicate it, but then you put it in a new cell. So on average, is one DNA molecule. There are about 30 RNA polymerase molecules available and about 100 ribosomes. These are small numbers, which lead to relative large fluctuations because all these chemical reactions are Poisson processes. You have relative large fluctuations in these rates. So this is the basic definition of the noise we're thinking about. It's just because we have small numbers of molecules. Right. So it depends on the state of the cell, but a healthy cell, you know, can have up to 3,000 to 5,000 different protein species. So you have hemoglobin, and you have ATP synthase or something. They're all different proteins, and the level of those proteins also strongly depends on what kind of protein it is. So some proteins are abundant, other proteins are, there are only a few copies of them. So the important point here is that those molecules are free, so they're waiting for a task. A lot of other RNA polymerase molecules or ribosomes are already synthesizing RNA or proteins. But if you want to know what the fluctuations are, you have to know what are the available numbers that are there to bind to a gene that has to be transcribed.
Each ribosome can be used more than once?
Yes, yeah. You can. So what can happen is, that's very important in this analysis, that for example, when you have one RNA molecule, a lot of ribosomes can bind, but the ribosomes themselves can, again, after their task, be recycled. Yeah.
The mRNA recycled too?
Yeah. We will come back to that later. It's important. The lifetime of the RNA depends strongly on what kind of RNA you have. So if you have a long-lived RNA, you can recycle a lot of times. And that's actually one very important parameter in this whole modeling. Just before going into our results, I would just talk a little bit about how this is relevant in biology. I'll give you one example. This is a phage, which is actually a virus for a bacteria. Virus is like a moon lander that lands on the surface of the bacteria and injects its DNA into the bacteria. It's typical what a virus does. For bacteria, it's called a phage. And this bacteria has only one question. It says, okay, do I want to go in the lysis state or lysogeny state? So lysis state means that this DNA will start to replicate very, very fast and make a lot of virus particles in the cell. And then the cell will lyse, which means that it bursts open. It kills the cells. Or it can decide to do lysogeny, which means that it will incorporate itself into the chromosome. So it will be there in the chromosome of the bacteria. So it will not replicate itself, but it will be in a dormant state. So this procedure is programmed into the genetics. So people have been studying this. So this is a theoretical model where people say, okay, this is the genetics. Don't worry about all the arrows. It's just to show you that it's complex. It's a lot of genes that are connected to each other. And they know all the rate constants of these. Chemical reactions. So the biologists really zoomed in on this, and they know exactly what the rate constants are. So what you can do, the people did, is they put this in a computer, and they use a Monte Carlo simulation to calculate, for example, what the concentration of the protein CI is as a function of time. And they start with two cells that are identical at t equals zero. They're really identical. I mean, they have the same DNA, but they also have the same number of proteins in the cell. So they're really identical. But then, as a function of time, they bifurcate. So for example, this cell has only a few number of molecules of CI. The other one has a lot, which triggers these different pathways. So when you start with a population of cells that are identical at a certain time, and then you let them, you switch on the noise, is that you see that you have two subpopulations of cells after a while. One fraction is bursting open, and the other one is dormant. In this case, there are only two possible pathways for this.
Experiment
also, yeah. In this case, bistable switches or lysis or lysogeny. People have been doing this also with experimental work. So there's no, if the DNA of the virus comes in the cell, it either will replicate itself and makes viruses in the cell, or it will incorporate in the chromosome. Is that what you mean? There's no other way, there's no other choice. Why is that? Well, I think that's good for survival. So all these things you can explain by saying that these cells have been around for billions of years, and the only way they're still here is because they're very good in surviving. So this is evolution is very important for this. Evolution is the mechanism that selects the cells that have the best program to survive, and this program is for this virus, surviving for billions of years. So that's I think why. I cannot prove that, but that's what most people say. Okay, little bit of experimental details here, just because I need that to explain the next transparencies. Is if you want to do an experiment in this field and you want to do a quantitative experiment on genetic expression, there is a really nice tool available. This was just available a couple of years ago, and it's a revolution in molecular biology. And we use this system. It's called a green fluorescent protein. It's a protein which is green. It normally exists in jellyfish. But what the biologists did is they took this jellyfish and they found the DNA that's responsible for this green protein, excised it out of the jellyfish, and now you can put it in any other organism you want. So that's the great thing about the central dogma. It's independent of any cell. The central dogma is the same for me as for you, but also for bacteria, it's the same. It's exactly the same. So my DNA, you can put my DNA into bacteria, and the bacteria will replicate it. So what they did is they took this green protein from the jellyfish and put it in the bacteria. So now what you can see is when you see that the bacteria turns green, it means that the gene is active. So you can use this as an active reporter. They call this a genetic reporter. Experimentally, that's really nice because this is not interfering with other pathways. It's non-toxic. So it's a really nice quantitative reporter. That's what we use to measure activity of a gene. So if you want to study noise, you have to have an output, and we use this output of this jellyfish protein. You have to rule out other sources of variation like temperature fluctuations or food sources. You have to know what the logic is of the genetics. For example, when you study this phage, you have to know what the program is. The program is very complex for the phage. So what we do is we make our own genetic circuits, very simple ones. We make a single gene, or we make two genes, or three genes. We make them in the lab. We fabricate them, not in the clean room, but in our wet lab. And because we fabricate these structures ourselves, we know exactly what the genetic logic is. And the other thing is you have to look at single cells, because when you want to look at a noise, it's not interesting to average over population, but you have to look at a single cell. So I was trying to convince you that it's interesting for biology because of what people call its non-genetic individuality. So you have DNA is, of course, important for your individuality. If you have two persons with different DNA, they will be different. But this program could explain why two identical twins are different. Well, two identical bacterial cells that are a clone have different protein expression, not because they have different DNA, but because they have their subject to fluctuations. Another customer field for this is engineers who want to make sensors or computers out of bacteria. And if you want to make these things stable, you don't want noise. So there's some exciting stuff going on where people make, for example, switches. So this was a paper in Nature last year by Jim Collins group at BU, where they make a toggle switch in E. coli. So the paper is called Genetic Toggle Switch. So what they can do is they artificially make now, so that it's not subject to evolution anymore, but you make it yourself. And they're able to make a switch. You can switch on and off by triggering the cell externally. So this could be an interesting sensor. That, for example, if the trigger is an external molecule in some pond or something, when the cells turn green, you know that molecule is there. Another paper, which was back-to-back with that paper, is what I call a ring oscillator by the group of Stan Leiber in Princeton. And what they do is they make similar circuit. Now it consists of three genes instead of two genes. And this is like three genes that are arranged in a circle. So one is switching on the other one, and the second one is switching on the third one, and the third one is switching on the first one. So it's a snake that's binding its own tail. And this system, if you measure the fluorescence now of a single cell, it's an oscillatory, it's periodic motion, a periodic signal. So this is an oscillator. So you can make switches, but you can also make oscillators. So you can use an oscillator to drive another circuit, for example. So the main problem with these artificially constructed networks is that they are very, very sensitive to noise. So what we're doing now is we try to understand this noise, mainly because we're interested in the biology, but also because of these sensors, which are important. So this was the introduction. Let me wrap it up quickly. Noise introduces non-genetic individuality. That's the biological part. Can be relevant for artificial circuits. definition is just because of fluctuations of the numbers, small numbers. We need to have some more thorough theoretical models to model this, other than these lengthy Monte Carlo simulations. They take this huge program and put it in the computer, but you really don't have any intuition what comes out. So we need more simple approaches that are not depending on this Monte Carlo stuff. And we have to look at a single gene. So that's what we do. That's the most simple basic element. So what we do is we take the central dogma and we put some rate constants in it. So DNA, RNA, protein, it's the same as there. But now we quantify the transitions by rate constants, KR, which is the rate constant from going from DNA to RNA. KP is the rate constant of translation. And there are also two rate constants that define the decay, because these two species, RNA and proteins, are not infinitely lived, but they're pretty unstable. So they die. So this is a simple approach. It's one of the approaches you can use to model this. So you can just say, okay, I have differential equations, I add white noise terms to that. And this is what you can do on the RNA level. So the first step, so you have the decay of the RNA, is the creation rate minus the decay rate plus a noise term. And when you assume it's white noise, so this is an assumption, you can do it for the whole system of coupled equations, where we have both a white noise term on RNA level and a white noise term at the protein level. And if you do the math, and you can also do this using a master equation approach, you can just solve the master equation. That's more, I would say, more proper to do, but it's more work and it's less intuitive. But it gives the same result. And the result is that if you measure the protein expression in a single cell, it will go up and down. It's noisy. You take the standard deviation of that signal, which is sigma p, you square it, that's the variance of the signal, then you normalize it to the mean, and that will be determined by this formula, which is 1, which is the Poisson noise, it's the Poisson limit. B is what we call the burst size, it's the ratio between Kp and gamma r. Kp is how efficient do I translate, the second step. Gamma r is how quickly does the RNA decays. So the burst size is actually how many proteins can I make before RNA disappears. So how many times can I recycle the RNA? So it's proportional to that. And then phi is the relative stability of the protein with respect to the RNA. Proteins are, in 99% of the cases, are much more stable than RNA molecules. This number is much more than 1. So this approximation of this formula, which is very good, is 1 plus b. 1 is the Poisson. Yeah, so the gammas are the lifetimes. So they are. Yeah. You can put in feedback. We did this also for more complex system with feedback and feed forwards. So this method is also possible for more complex system, but this is linear, completely linear. Yeah. So, okay, now let's see what. So this is again the same formula. In this picture, I plot the noise strength, which is the variance over the mean, divided over the mean as a function of the mean. So what you could do when you look at a formula, I can, for example, change the protein half-life, which changes gamma p. When I would do that, that's experimentally possible. I would follow the green symbols. So it will saturate at a certain level. And because gamma is in the denominator, and because of the RNA lifetime is very, very short, it doesn't really matter if you change the protein half-life. Because the protein half-life is much longer than the RNA half-life. So changing the protein half-life doesn't change the noise a lot. If you change the transcription rate, so I make this step much more efficient, nothing happens because there's no KR in this formula. This formula is completely independent of KR. So transcription is not important. I change B, which is something that has to do with the translation, it goes up linearly. So basically this model tells us that the noise is controlled at translational level. The only way you can change the noise is by changing B which is either by changing Kp, which is the how efficient do I translate, or by changing the lifetime of the RNA, which you mentioned. So we did, we double-checked this analytical model by doing Monte Carlo simulations. And we actually found out that, so this is a Monte Carlo simulation of the full linear equations for different burst sizes. So you see the protein number is a function of time, the noise is larger when the burst size is larger. But when you zoom in, you see that the proteins are produced in bursts, where the burst height, like the peak height, is on average B. And the timing is determined by transcription initiation, like 1 over KR. So this is why we call this the burst size model, because what you do, the noise goes up because you inject a lot of proteins at once in the cytoplasm. Then you wait a while until the next transcription occurs. Then you again inject B molecules in the cell. So we have huge peaks, which give you a high noise. So this is like the hand-waving way to think about this noise. Okay, let's go to experiments. So what we wanted to prove is now we want to measure the noise, and we want to measure the change in noise if you change parameters, like, for example, when you change KR, or when you change KP, or when you change gamma R or gamma P. So we decided to study what happens if you change KR and KP. The lifetimes are difficult to change, because you have to change the protein itself. The lifetime of RNA molecule and the lifetime of a protein are determined by the structure of RNA and the structure of the protein. It's really difficult to predict how to change the lifetime if you change the protein. And if we change the protein too much, it will not be fluorescent anymore. So we don't want to mess with the protein or the RNA. So what we do is we change transcriptional and translational efficiency. So this is how biologists do it on the transcriptional level. They use a so-called inducer. And the inducer is a small molecule. So this is how we trigger the gene expression. We add inducer to the media of the molecules, of the cells. This is the DNA, which has a promoter. The promoter is called the initiation site of the gene. It's the start of the gene. That's normally what happens, the RNA polymerase, that's the molecule that reads the DNA, lands on the promoter and starts to read it. However, in our system, we have another molecule, which is called a repressor, that binds just next to the promoter and blocks the transcription, blocks the way for the RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase cannot transcribe because there is a repressor. However, when we add inducer, the inducer will bind the repressor and will open up the way. So it's a competition between inducer binding and repressor binding. So by changing the concentration of inducer in the media of the cells, we can actually change the transcriptional efficiency, how efficient the transcription is. So this is how we change KR. Then we also want to change KP. KP is a translational efficiency. So what we have to do there is we have to make the ribosome to bind more strongly or less strongly to the RNA. So the way to do it, the easiest way to do it, as we found out, is that you just put mutations into the RNA. So when you change the sequence of the RNA where the ribosome binds, you can change the binding affinity of the ribosome. So we put in point mutations close to the ribosome binding site, and this makes the ribosome bind more stronger or less stronger. So when it binds very strong, KP will be high. When it binds not very strong, it will be lower. So this is how we change KP. We just make different strains of bacteria that have different mutations. Okay, so how do we measure this experimentally? So we use a so-called flow cytometer. So this is a system where we have a laser that's focused into a small capillary. Capillary is here. And the cells are flowing through the capillary at high speed. When they go through the laser volume, the laser will excite the fluorescence and they burst off their photons. We detect the photons on a couple of detectors. The most important detector is the fluorescence detector, so we just measure how many photons are there. But we also measure the scattering of the object. So you have a side scatter and a forward scatter, and this will determine, the size of the object. So we measure kind of the size of the object, and we measure how much fluorescence is coming through. The nice thing about this, you can do this at a high speed. And because we're doing statistics, we have to do this for a lot of cells. So a typical histogram looks like this. We measure 10 to the fourth or 10 to the fifth cells, and we arrange them in a histogram. So a histogram has a certain mean and a certain variance. And those two numbers we extract from this histogram. And now we do this for a lot of different cells. So cells with mutations, cells in the presence of this inducer, cells in the absence of the inducer. And this is how we can explore phase space. We can explore phase space by changing KR, by changing inducer. We can explore KP, the KP direction, by changing the mutations. And well, these are the results after hard work. We did a lot of experiments with this, and this is the statistical analysis. So on the y-axis, we have the noise, which is the variance over the mean. So every point comes from one histogram, which comes from one experiment on like a million of cells. And here we have the transcriptional efficiency on the left-hand side and the translational efficiency on the right-hand side. So this is the first step with central dogma. This is the second step. So if you do statistics on this, we measure that the correlation between the noise and translation and the noise and transcription is much more stronger in the case of translation. So this is something we expected from the modeling. However, we also see a weak correlation with transcription, which we don't really understand at this point. But we're very happy to see that we can statistically see a difference between translational and transcriptional noise. So this means that cells also can change that. I mean, if you go from, this is a different cell than this cell. It's a cell that was mutated by us. But evolution does this all the time. So evolution can make cells more noisy or less noisy, dependent on where the mutation is. So how can this be relevant in a broader context? So this is a speculation, but I think it's a nice speculation. So you can ask yourself, okay, you want a certain number of proteins in your cell. You can do this in two different ways. You have two knobs to turn. You can turn this knob, and you can turn this knob. It's a two knobs to get one variable. So you can do that in an infinite number of ways. However, when you want to be careful with your energy, you want to recycle your RNA molecules as many times as possible. So what I would do is I would put the knob here at maximum, and this one at minimum, because I will recycle my RNA molecules lots of times. And I don't have to spend energy, which is good because I can spend energy for other things and I will survive evolution. However, if you do that, you will have a lot of noise. So I was saying it not correctly. What I was saying is you want to recycle the RNA molecules, you have to put this knob at full max. This one, you want to make one RNA molecule and you want to recycle this many times. So this knob is the second knob is full max, the first knob is close to zero. This will cost you no energy, but will have a lot of noise because it's high bursts. So what I'm speculating about is that there can be a possible management between energy and noise. And what we were doing is we were using bioinformatics tools to find genes in the genome of E. coli that are very poorly translated. And there are a lot of genes, actually, that are very poorly translated. And all those genes are involved in very important cascades, regulatory cascades. You don't want proteins to be noisy when they're involved in a lot of different pathways. This is speculation. We cannot prove that at this point. But this could be the important biological relevance. Conclusions. So by doing our experiments, we showed that the main regulation of noise is at the translation level, which is qualitatively in agreement with our models. We see a correlation also with transcription. It's like about fivefold smaller. So cells can regulate the mean by changing transcription and translation, but you can only change noise by translation. That's an interesting fact. I want to acknowledge my graduate students and people at the biology department who we're collaborating with, because it's really difficult to do this on your own. Because we have to use a lot of technologies from biology. I think really the combination is really powerful. And what we're doing in the future is we're going to look at noise, how it propagates. So now we're looking at single gene, but now we're going to inject it into a cascade. We want to directly measure transcription dynamics. And we're going to really complex networks like this sugar decision network I was telling you about. How do bacteria decide what to eat? We also want to look at that. And again, there's a lot of need for more quantitative people and quantitative theoretical modeling people in this field that could, you know, we can collaborate with and could initiate interesting new experiments. Thanks a lot. Right. So the mutations are actually not in the coding part of the RNA, but they're only in the ribosome binding site. So first of all, if there will be a mutation in that region, it will not affect the structure of the RNA. And the other thing is that this has been done by other people before. So we actually use those results. People have been measuring the efficiency of the mutation, and they have been measuring, you know, RNA stability, protein stability. So these things, these are the standard mutations people use to do these kind of changing affinity constants. So I didn't do those experiments, but they have been done years ago by the biologists.
A couple more questions, and would you stand up for
you? How do you quantitate efficiency of translation and of transcription? You show that
yes. Very good question. So we normalize the the transcription efficiency is defined by normalizing to full induction. So when we saturate the media with inducer, we assume that the repressor is never touching the DNA anymore. So it's open, completely open. So we normalize that to the maximum induction. So this one, that's why also these all these numbers are here. I mean, all these points are one column because we normalize them to the full induction. Here we normalize to the cells that have a wild type mutation. So
that's how you measure it, how you define those problems. What is efficiency of transcription? Number of molecules per one.
It's when I have a transcription efficiency of 0.5, it means that I have half the number of proteins in the end than when I would fully induce them. So full induction, which means that there's no repression of the gene anymore. Now I make X genes. Transcription efficiency will be, okay, now I change IPTG, the inducer. Now I have 0.5 times X for that cell. So this is proportional to the number of proteins, actually.
Relative
change.
One more question.
You mentioned that noise might be more tolerable if the protein is less important somehow. What does the number of proteins play a role? I can imagine if there are just many of them, then right. You only care about the average and noise will be around.
Yes. That's correct. Yeah. So if the molecules are available in millions, but yeah. You're right, but that's not a condition that's happening in cells. So typical numbers of proteins are between 1 and say 100, sometimes 1,000. So they're in small numbers, at least in our systems. I don't know about, you know, human cells that are much larger. In human cells, it's also much more difficult because these two processes are in different compartments. You have a nucleus and you have a cytoplasm. For bacteria and small cells like yeast, typical number of proteins are between 1 and 1,000.
Okay, thank you.